Welcome to Tomo Chaco Podcast, a Yuri podcast by queer people for queer people. I'm your local bisexual disaster, Kit.
And I'm Sarah.
And this week is super exciting because we have Jude here with us, everybody.
Yay!
Hello, I'm Jude. I'm, I guess, the guest resident trans person and also pansexual.
Yeah, so tell our enraptured radio audience all about yourself.
So, in the beginning, so I'm 27. I am a non-binary trans man. I first came out to my mom when I was 8 years old, and you know, it was the early 2000s, and trans information was so limited at that time, like resources and how to go about it. So my mom was like, "When you're 18, you can do whatever you want." So I was like, okay, that sounds like a rational, reasonable answer. Struggled with my gender identity through my teens. 18 years old, I, you know, was getting into early cosplay at that point in time. A cosplayer I followed had been very open about his transition, and I came out again to my mom, and I was like, hey, I'm trans. And here I am now.
Hey, remember that thing we talked about 10 years ago? Still true.
Yeah, still true. Exactly. Yep, I started hormone therapy in 2000, January 2014? No, 15, somewhere in there. And recently, it was one of those early transition things where I felt like I had to ascribe a little bit more to the binary and like my early outset, and so my gender exploration in recent has been coming more to terms with the fact that I do identify more as non-binary and being more open about that. Because especially in recent, I found that the non-binary representation in the community has been a little bit stifled, and, you know, people need to see that, like, that's we out here.
It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So I think that we'll do our little interview shtick. It was really hard coming up with questions because I was like, I know Jude. What am I going to ask?
I know.
So I think we'll just do our normal question that we ask everyone, which is, what does representation mean to you, and how do you bring that attitude into your work and the things that you do?
It's kind of a hefty question, so...
Yeah. And I feel like I did touch on it a little bit already. So I think it's... Representation, I feel like, is the ability to, like, know where to look and who you're seeing and what they're about without it being something that's... I don't want to... Glorified's not the right word. Sensationalized. That it's just... normal, essentially. Like, a lot of times in media you get like, oh, such and such, it's such a big deal that they're queer or they're gay or they're just they're different. And one of the things that I have been thinking about is, like, you know, sometimes it's really tricky to play or like reach out and want to be or be able to be a different person because you have to ascribe to a binary, and if you're outside that binary, you have to be some sort of very almost alien sense of what is human. You have to be that weird, like, you know, you have the crazy hair and, you know, no eyebrows and tons of piercings and whatnot, because that's clearly what being queer is. And for some people it is, but for others it's not. It's just being able to exist and, like, have a cup of tea or wear sweaters and go out to the movies and whatnot. It's, I feel like representation is the ability to see yourself in something where you are able to just exist. I've actually been in my day job working a lot with the HR team in how can we bring a safe environment and representation to my workplace as both a guest-facing experience as well as an internal experience for employees, because for the longest time it was really just a lot of cis people in my workplace, and now we have more non-binary people and trans people that are entering this workplace, and how can we make it feel safe, especially in an instance where somebody encounters, you know, the like microaggressions that come with people not understanding what it is to be trans, or how do we approach a situation where someone's being misgendered and someone tries to correct them and they, you know, approach it the wrong way and take it personally. So I've actually actively been working on trying to make my like day job workplace a better environment for people that are trans, not only for my benefit but for others too in the future and in current.
That's super dope.
It is.
Like, that's
and it's
awesome.
So hard.
It is. It's so hard. There's some days where I'm like, I'm so tired of having these conversations, but they're necessary.
Yeah.
As someone who one major part of my 90-day review at one of my last jobs was that I was being too gay at work, I very much appreciate your efforts.
Yeah. I'm shocked. But I guess I also shouldn't be shocked, but I'm still shocked to hear that that was actually a part of your review.
Yeah, that was a real thing that happened. And I remember even, because, you know, I tend to dress more masculinely, just and be more masculine facing in my daily life. And so one of those things is I really like to wear ties. And so occasionally I would wear ties to work because why not? It was an office-ish environment. It was appropriate. And they had been under, like, some rumor had spread that I was, like, trying to indoctrinate all of the children into, like, not following the gender binary. And so they were talking to me about the way that I dressed, too. And I was like, is this really happening right now? Is this my life?
You're dressing too professionally. We can't have you looking so professional. It's going to confuse the children.
Your ties are too nicely tied.
What sort of knot is that? A Windsor? We can't have Windsors here.
Right. I'm really glad that, like, you work in an environment that's super open to that and is trying to work with you to make that happen. That's super great.
Yeah, it's been really nice. I've worked at places where it was definitely not as welcoming, and I was very concerned and worried at, like, first going in that it was going to be another situation like that. So it's a lot of work, but it's nice that I can even put the work in, and it's appreciated.
I think we should talk about how we all met, because I think it's really funny that we both knew them separately.
Yes. Okay, this is actually a pretty funny story. So I can't even remember how I met Amanda at this point. It had to have been through some SakuraCon cosplay-related thing.
It had to have been, I believe so.
Yeah, and that was 3 or 4 years ago now, and we had just, like, been friends through cosplay for a while. And then I remember starting the podcast and, like, looking for a co-host and whatever, and a completely separate friend was like, oh, my girlfriend's coworker would like to be on this show. And so then I, you know, started hanging out with Sarah, and I was like, oh yeah, this is the person who's gonna draw you. And she was like, wait, what?
So when was that we met? Do you remember? It was so long ago.
Let's see. I think it was the second SakuraCon that I went to when I moved out here, which means it would have been probably 2013. And that was the year that we did our Silent Hill skit in the cosplay competition, mm-hmm. and we did the Silent Hill cosplays.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, because you guys were in Silent Hill costumes. I don't remember what we were doing exactly.
I believe you were doing Heather and Alessa from Silent Hill 3.
That's right.
Yeah. And Amanda was Valtiel, and then I was Monster Murphy from.
And we were so excited. Yeah. We were like, oh my God. We
saw each other on the escalator. We're like, get off. We gotta get photos.
We like saw each other on the escalators. And we were just like pointing and freaking out.
Yeah. That was really fun. It was delightful.
It was so good. And then, yeah, so years and years later, we've talked about how we met, but like my coworker slash friend was like, oh, my boyfriend's friend is doing this podcast and she's looking for a co-host. And I was like, okay, I'll send a message. Sure. Like the most out of character thing I've ever done in my boring and shy life.
And it was especially funny because I just like, when I got the message, I wanted to respond right away, but I didn't have a lot of bandwidth to do it. So I just ended up like dogpiling her with all caps, really excited questions. And then I was like, sorry, I will compose myself.
So yeah, then later she was like, oh yeah, this artist is gonna do our splash screens for us. So like, you know, tell me, like, send me pictures and stuff. And she told me who it was, and I was like, wait. Wait. I know her. I know that person.
And now we're all here.
Yeah. Right? And now we're all here.
The Pacific Northwest cosplay community is truly very small.
It is.
Even though it feels very large.
So with that, let's go ahead and slide right into gay shit we're excited about. Jude, since you are the guest, you can go first.
So last night, Amanda was playing We Happy Few to get caught up on the DLC. And one in We Happy Few, it's this... It's so hard to describe because it's so many different things. It's sort of like this weird dystopian, like, imply that there was, like, very man-made apocalyptic sort of events. The best I can describe from, like, gameplay is that it's like if England lost the war, World War II, and the Germans have essentially created this sort of weird social experiment. I don't know if that's exactly the lore, but that's definitely what it feels like. And so the world is kind of trapped in this like very 1960s, like everything's great, psychedelic, wonderful. And throughout your journey in the main storyline, you meet a couple of characters that are air quotes confirmed bachelors, which is essentially the term for being gay in that particular time frame. And at first, like, you have this unreliable narrator thing with Arthur where they just seem kind of like really silly, not very serious, probably idiots. And so you're just like, oh, these characters are delightful, but like, it's kind of tropish. And in the DLC that they did, I believe the name of it is It Came From Below, but I'm not sure. It's the first DLC that they released, and it focuses on James and Roger, and they're exploring these robots that live in a cave underneath the estate that they're in, that the Dr. Faraday that they serve or help assist with her experiments. She does all of her experiments in this mansion, and you're going through and you're exploring all of it. And you learn more about the characters, and you learn that Roger, the character that you play as, has absolute love and fascination for science fiction, and he's really invested in it. James kind of doesn't take him seriously because he's just like, you're so like up in the clouds, you're like dreaming about things all the time, and like, you know, you're very irresponsible, and I need to be the one to take care of you, sort of thing. But you find out that Roger is a lot more competent than he seems, and he's actually extremely intelligent. So it's this really interesting exploration of like their characters, and they have this beautiful moment at the end where it can be beautiful or it can be sad. You can either split them up or they can go off together to space and live with robots. But it's like, it's really sweet how much that they constantly talk about how they love each other, and like they're just together with it, with each other for forever. That's their goal, that's their dream, that's their intention, and you can make that happen. It's very sweet. So that was a really cool gay thing, and I felt like Compulsion Games definitely put a lot of heart into that DLC.
Dude, that's awesome.
Everything you described about that game sounds like exactly my aesthetic.
It's so fun.
It's probably only on PC, right?
It is also on PlayStation 4, and I think it's on Xbox One as well.
Oh, okay.
One of my favorite just general memories is 2 years ago when we were all at SoccerCon just listening to the We Happy Few like TV spots yeah. in the mornings.
Just Uncle Jack singing us to a bright and wonderful morning.
It was beautiful. That game has an excellent aesthetic and I love it. I'm just going to go ahead real quick and plug She-Ra for the 15th time. Because season 3 came out, and I was like, oh, I'll just watch one episode, and I'll go back to playing Fire Emblem Three Houses, which I also want to talk about. But, and then I watched the whole thing. I was like, oh, this will just be a quick break. No, I couldn't stop watching it. Once I got to, I think, episode 3, I was like, no, I have to see how this ends.
We just finished episode 3 last night, and it was so... so good. Yeah. every time I watch She-Ra, I'm reminded of Noelle Stevenson saying, just assume that all the characters I write are gay.
For real, though. It's I think, probably one of the gayest seasons. But also, Noelle, what the fuck? What made you think any of that was okay?
No spoilers!
I'm not going to spoil. I'm just going to say I'm not okay. So watch at your own risk. It's very good, though. And then I want to talk about Fire Emblem Three Houses, because usually Fire Emblem games, not great for queer representation. And there's been a lot of kind of discourse about the representation or lack thereof in the Fire Emblem games. And this one definitely isn't perfect, but... I think that it's a huge step forward, and it's also a very fun game, so there's that. I know that the options for male romances are not particularly explicit. I think there's only one where it's super explicit, and the other ones are more like, oh, I'm a knight and I'm pledging myself to you, whatever.
At first when you said explicit, I was like, is there sex in these games?
No, I mean, like, explicitly
I like,
said.
I was like, wait, are
this is not Mass Effect.
Have I been sleeping on this Fire Emblem thing? There's been, like...
But if you're going for woo-woo romances, and yes, I'm going to use that term because it makes me laugh, you have, I think, 5 options to choose from, and they're all, like, super varied, complex, and interesting women, and I'm really a fan of that.
Hmm.
I feel like I actually have options beyond, like, the typical tropes that you would find in a lot of those dating sim-type things, and that's really cool. So, Fire Emblem Three Houses, it's great. I've never played a Fire Emblem game before, but I love this one.
I've also been seeing a lot of really great fan art of the women in that game, as well mm-hmm. as like a ton of memes. But
my god, the memes are so funny.
The memes are so good. But yeah, I've definitely been seeing a lot of people that are really enthused about the women characters, and it's definitely got me interested. Also, as a person that's never played Fire Emblem game before, I definitely want to check it out.
I think that the writing and the voice acting are really what make it, because all of these characters have, like, really interesting and complex, like, backstories and personalities, and the entire game is fully voiced. Every single line of dialogue is voiced.
Jeez.
Which just kind of adds that extra layer of depth. So, yeah, it's great. Go play it. Apparently, I'm in the minority. I found a physical copy of that game. Apparently, there are none of them.
Oh, wow. But,
yeah, I would recommend it. So, with that, let's just slide right into to the normal episode and talk about Our Dreams at Dusk Volume 2. Sarah, whose turn is it to do the summary?
No, I don't remember.
Unless, Jude, do you want to summarize this volume? I don't want to put you on the spot.
Okay, so the volume as a whole?
Yeah.
Yes.
Let's see if I can do this. So in Volume 1, we learned about our protagonist Kaname coming to terms with his identity as being gay and how to personally resolve the crush that he had on one of his classmates or peers, since they're not actually classmates. In this volume, we explore the continuation of him grappling with how to approach his crush, and we also learn more about another character that exists in the space of the drop-in center, Misora, and Misora's exploration of exploring their gender identity and how they feel with exploring gender identity as a whole and as a concept, and how that affects also their interpersonal relationships. And Kaname definitely takes a very personal attachment and approach to helping Misora explore their identity.
Can I just say that's a better summary than anything we've ever done on this terrible show? Good. God, we gotta step it up, apparently.
This is June's show now.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, don't. That was dope. That was really good.
Thank you.
This is why we have guests, so they can be better than us,
right? We're not very good.
So there's some good content on this show.
Let's go ahead and normally we start with like the things that we didn't like. There's not a lot in this one, at least for me. I didn't have anything I really didn't like about the other one either. They're just very good.
It was super hard to read in the sense that, like, it's so, the things that happen are so rough and, like, it's so, it doesn't flinch away from any, like, from making things really ugly, if that makes sense.
It's emotionally intense.
It's really, really emotionally intense. But that's not, like, a bad thing about the book. It's just, if you aren't in, like, a good place, you might want to wait a little bit to read it.
That does remind me, we should do trigger warnings.
Oh, yeah, we do need to do some trigger warnings.
And definitely homophobia. Jude, would you say transphobia?
I would say that there's probably some mild transphobia, yeah.
And of course, there's all of our favorite homophobic slurs are back.
Yeah, there's a lot of slurs.
I didn't think that there would be, like, a larger volume than there was in volume one, but yeah, there's a lot.
There's a lot.
And
there's sexual harassment.
Yeah, sexual harassment. I was just thinking about that.
But I think that's it.
I believe so, yeah.
So let's just kind of go. Mm-hmm. It's so hard, like, I read the first one, and I remember saying this in our Dreams at Dusk episode. When I read the first volume, I was like, I don't know if I'm equipped to talk about this one, but I guess I'm gonna try. And then I read volume two, and I was like, nope.
Even less equipped.
Even less equipped.
Yeah. It tackles some really heavy and really interesting issues. I really like that the way that they approach Misora's story is in such an uncertain way. I like that we're allowed to sit in that uncertainty for a while. Like, there isn't a clear resolution. Like, there's no, like, oh, Misora isn't like, oh, yeah, I'm trans, you know, that's how it is. It's like they're still figuring out their gender identity, and we as the reader have to sit in that uncertainty with them. And I think that's it's difficult, but it's really good.
Yeah, I would agree. And I want to, like, first off, going in, I'm going to try and stick to using they, them pronouns for Misora because the summary on the back of the volume does, but also it fluctuates in the in the novel itself of which pronouns to use. Misora does state, you know, I'm a boy, but then, you know, people are unsure. Like, there's a bit where they use, I think, his or him, and it's in air quotes. And so I'm just going to personally use they, them pronouns.
And I think that fits with the tone of the book, too, because anytime they use, like, kun to refer to Misora, they correct themselves and they change it to san.
Right. Yeah.
Which is the gender-neutral honorific. So I think they, them pronouns, it makes perfect sense. And the thing that I really liked about this is I love the way that this series explores these issues really complexly. And use it. That first of all, the art is gorgeous again.
Of course.
It continues to just be wonderful. But the way that it uses that visual metaphor to kind of add to that complexity while also communicating in very simple terms what's happening. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I wrote in my notes, like, the sheer unflinching reality of the situation under things that I liked. Because I think that this was, like you were saying, a really realistic thing to sit in this uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And to have to play with it. Jude, what do you think?
Well, first, I do want to talk about, like, one of the things visually I enjoy about this is the way that it creates a physical visualization for feelings of ephemera. So, like, there in Volume 1, there's the depiction of Kaname having a panic attack, and it felt so, like, innately visceral. Like, if you know what that feeling is like, you can definitely, like, understand where he's feeling, like, that sense of having a panic attack. And then also in Volume 2, we have all these like fish, floaty, mermaid-ish aesthetics that revolve around Misora. And there's like a brief bit with Kaname where he's having a conversation with one of his classmates, and there's like the kind of like goldfish and sparkles that kind of come out of his mouth, that feeling of like having that fluttery crush and like not knowing what to do with it and trying to kind of hide your feelings that you have and that excitement. It was very interesting to me.
I loved those panels.
Yeah, they're so nice and interesting just visually. They just really encapture like how that feeling feels without like taking away from this isn't a fantastical supernatural sort of environment. It's just that that's the way that they depict this visually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I loved those panels, and then I really liked how it shows Kaname like holding the sparkles up to his face and like breathing them in, and then in the next panel his friend interrupts them, and there's this like the sense of like the bubble popping.
Yeah.
I think one of my favorites was Misora's very visually tied to water.
Yeah.
in this. And there you see a lot of the goldfish floating up from the record player or looking through the glass of the bowl and seeing everything floating and kind of being distorted. But my personal favorite was when we're looking through the glass of water through the ice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to find that. It's so good.
It's when he visits him in his house.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it's just, I think that it does a really excellent job of conveying what's happening without having to, like, tell you anything explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can see him through the ice cubes, mm-hmm. and I think that that's a really good way to convey how he's trying to sort of freeze people from being close to him and push them away while maintaining the sort of, like, visual metaphor of water.
Mm-hmm.
Gender is fluid?
Hey! You know what?
I know, until we started talking about all of the water metaphors, I didn't even catch that, and then when we started talking about it, I was like,
I know, me too. Like, ah. the visual metaphors and like all the different layers, it's deep.
Kamatani, oh my god. Kamatani, you did this on purpose.
I also really like the spread of Misora leaving the drop-in center in the yukata.
Yeah, I love this shot of them in the yukata for the first time, like stepping out of the house or out of the drop-in center, and there's, again, like, that sense of, like, weightlessness, like, in the water,
mm-hmm.
and there's almost, like, a water effects, like, around them, and then they hit the ground, and it's just like, ah.
And there's that close-up of, like, the sunlight on their face, too.
Mm-hmm. Also, on a really superficial level, can I just say I love their yukata so much? I want one. I want a goldfish yukata, please. Please give me.
So, one of the things that I think would be, and I remember we talked about this a little bit during sound check, I thought it was really interesting, and I can't tell if this is a thing that was positive or negative. I think it, for lack of a better term, floats kind of in that middle space of Kaname trying to help Mizora figure things out. Because on the one hand, I'm like, oh, well, I think that that is wonderful that he's trying to help them. But at the same time, I kind of agree with what Daichi said of the, well, if you push, you have to be prepared for them to push back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just that, you know, Misora wasn't ready for that. So with the whole thing with Kaname kind of like taking this personal responsibility almost of like helping Misora through exploring their gender identity and whatnot is there's this thing that happens when you're trans and you come out to like cis family members or friends. And if they're trying to be supportive, there's sometimes this thing that happens where they'll be almost what I consider too supportive. I have sometimes even used the term needing the trans cookies, in that I've had people where, like, I'll come out as trans and they'll be like, oh yeah, like, it's super positive and friendly. And then they'll come up to me and be like, oh hey, did you watch such and such media with a trans character in it? And like, it's to an extreme almost of being just needing that validation of like, see, I'm being supportive because I'm going out of my way to learn about this thing that you're going through. And like, you know, you have to like say like, oh yeah, great job, you're being a great ally. And it can be really overwhelming, and especially for someone that's trying to figure it out themselves, I can understand definitely why, like, that would be oppressive a little bit for Misora, in, like, not in a, like, social oppression sort of way, but as a, like, as a smothering sort of thing. Because a lot of times, like, people will be like, I remember when there was the job that I had when I started my hormone therapy and whatnot, and there was someone that was just like, oh, did you see the movie The Danish Girl with Eddie Redmayne playing a such and such character, and have you watched Transparent, and like, what are your opinions on the whole Jenner family situation and Caitlyn Jenner, and people being like, oh, I watched such and such trans documentary, like, you should watch it. And it's just like, I'm...
this isn't my whole personality, just so you know.
Yeah. Just like, I haven't watched it, but like, get around to it. Have you played The Evil Within? Horror game. That's what I'm about. So like, I can understand why it's just, Misora is just trying to go at their own pace, and to suddenly have someone being like, oh, you have this thing that you're going through, I'm going to help you get through it. I don't know anything about your situation, but I'm going to learn about it and read about it, and I'm going to be the authority to help you through it because you don't have anyone else to do it. It's a lot.
Right.
Yeah, it's so much.
I think part of it, too, is, like, Kaname is still figuring out his own shit.
Mm-hmm.
And so having somebody else to, like, take under his wing makes him feel like he's more in control of his own situation.
Yeah.
And so you get this, you know, he's mixing all of these issues where he does want to help Misora. Like, he is trying to be helpful in a way, but he's also trying to get his own validation by seeing Misora's situation resolved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, and it, I don't even know if it's necessarily that he's like, oh, look at what a good ally I'm being. It's that he wants to help somebody else so that he will feel better about his own situation.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that it's really funny because they push back against each other, mm-hmm, in a really interesting way, because Kaname does all this stuff to try to push Misora into accepting themselves one way or the other. And then Misora comes back with, like, so, have you ever had gay sex?
Right.
Which is something that makes Kaname just as equally uncomfortable as he's making Misora.
Yeah.
And they don't pick up on it.
Yeah.
I think Misora picks up on it. I mean, I think Misora is doing
Misora absolutely does it on purpose.
Yeah. Misora is like, okay, well, if you're going to put me on the spot, then how about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I really like that for several different reasons. Number one, I think it's a super well-written, like, narrative plot. But also, as somebody who works with sixth grade children, yeah, that's how they are.
Yeah, they're just old enough to see the buttons and push them.
Yeah, and so I really liked the way that they had the relationship that they had. I also really liked the way they kept being compared to cats.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't notice this the first time that I read it, but the second time that I read it, almost every single time there's like some sort of friction between the two characters, there's a panel that has those two cats in it. And it's really obvious when they're fighting on the street at night, but then it's less obvious when you see, like, there's a couple panels where it's just Kaname and they're even just, like, talking about Mizora, and then you see the cats in the rafters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I thought that was another really well-done visual metaphor.
And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how Kaname and Misora's relationship evolves mm-hmm. over time, because even though this was an extremely horrible fight to witness, mm-hmm. I think they will like have a really cool and interesting relationship later on in the comic. At least I hope so. Like, mm-hmm. I think there's potential for them to be, like, really good and really, like, interesting friends to watch,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. Like, it's the kind of relationship that I like to watch in media,
mm-hmm.
where there's, like, a little bit of friction, but still, like, trying to be, like, good friends to each other in yeah. their own way.
Well, and I think that relationship really is only going to kind of begin to heal when Kaname becomes self-aware enough to realize what he did wrong.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Because I think that the pushing itself was something that could have been that the character could have handled differently, but I also think that like there was just some things that were said because they were supposed to be supportive, but they were very much not supportive.
I mean, we could just talk about the scene with the yeah. with the sexual harassment that happens that leads up to their huge fight. So, just to, like, briefly recap, they go to this festival together, and they're actually having a really good time, mostly, up until this point where somebody gropes Misora on the street, and trying to be helpful and supportive, but completely horribly missing the mark.
Oh my god.
Kaname says they went after you because you're so cute, which is like on every level so very bad.
Yeah.
So extremely bad. It wouldn't be our delightful protagonist if he didn't stick his foot directly into his mouth in a really horrible way.
Yeah, I remember. And it was funny because it had a moment where I also had to, like, call myself out a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because the first time that I read this through, admittedly, it was fairly quickly. I was mostly just, like, reading it to enjoy the story, not to, like, really analyze it and think about it. But I was like, why did they get so mad at him?
Oh.
That was when the first time I read it, and then I read it the second time, and I was like, oh,
yeah.
Wait, yeah. I should have picked up on that.
Yeah, it's definitely one where when you, like, read it and you think about it, if you're, like, aware of that sort of thing, you think, oh, Kaname's first response should have been, like, are you okay? Like, do you want to go home? Like, can you recognize who it was? Trying to actually, like, solve the problem and make sure that Misora was okay instead of just being like, oh, well, you know, excuse this, excuse that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Almost in kind of a victim-blamey way.
Yeah.
Which I was like, oh, that's not good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We have Kaname, who, like, we sympathize with because he's the protagonist and we understand his, like, inner thoughts and we understand that he's trying to do a good job. Basically, he's trying to do right by Misora, but he still messes up so, so terribly. And I think there's been a time in every queer person's life where that has probably happened, where you have said something to somebody else that was so bad and so wrong, and you are like, oh my god, like, later on you think about it and you're like, oh my god, that's so bad. I was trying to be good and I did such a bad job. And So I think it's really good just in the sense that, like, being a queer person doesn't mean that you're an expert. Like, it doesn't mean that you automatically know all about all queer issues ever. Like, we all still have to do a lot of work, and we're all still going to mess up. And it's always going to be, you know, a learning experience for all of us. And we just have to be aware of that.
Exactly.
And, like, I wasn't sure, like, how good I would be at speaking about, like, the issues present here, because I was like, oh, it looks like it might be more of, like, a person that is a trans woman identifying and whatnot, so maybe I won't have the same level of, like, understanding. And essentially, like, going into it, I was like, I'll read it, and if there's anything that I feel like I need to go and, like, look more into, more knowledge that I don't already know about what it, like, is like being a trans woman versus being a trans man / non-binary person, then I'll go look up that stuff so that I can have a more educated point of view. But it's definitely, like, everything is still so, like, in its formation and early stages of exploration. So it's definitely, like, an experience that I could relate to still without any sort of specific direction of being, like, being DFAB transitioning or DMAB transitioning. And to put that out of acronym for people that don't know what that is, DFAB being designed female at birth or DMAB designed male at birth. You also may have seen AFAB or AMAB around as well, which is assigned female at birth or assigned male at birth. They're used interchangeably, but they do still have slightly different connotations. Even I'm not, like, clear on which one is the preferred one in the community right now, because it kind of, it's very nebulous. It just depends on, I think, like, social context and language stuff.
Right.
That was, one of the things that I kind of was thinking about, because when I picked up this book, I was like, okay, well, I know it has to do a lot with, like, trans issues and gender identity. So I feel like we need that voice on the show to help balance this out, because I don't think I'm going to be able to speak on these things intelligently. And after I read it, I was like, maybe we should have, like, should we have picked someone different? But I'm glad that it still worked out and we were able to be able to talk about it.
Yeah.
In that way.
And I mean, I don't want to, like, downplay, like, the specificity of this at all. But I feel like a lot of people can relate to just the idea of struggling with your gender identity and trying to, like, explore your gender identity and trying to, like, figure out, like, is my gender identity actually, like, different than what I was assigned? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like a lot of people go through that.
Yeah.
Even if it's not necessarily, like, in this specific way.
Zoolander staring into the water going, who am I?
I was gonna say, for those who don't follow me on Twitter, like a week ago, I think, coincidentally, almost in line with when I read this book, I posted a fairly large thread about fashion and gender identity and kind of my personal struggles with it. And what that kind of boils down to is I like dressing masculinely. You know, I like the kind of, like, for lack of a better term, butch lesbian aesthetic.
Which is fine.
Yeah. And
you could be a butch lesbian.
Exactly. And it,
or not.
It's difficult as a plus-sized person, because every time I try to, like, find more masculine clothes, they don't fit me. And I've always had, you know, issues with shopping and finding clothes and whatever, but I started to feel, like, particularly upset about my body when I was kind of trying to figure out how I wanted to present myself and things like that, because I really hated my body. And I was like, maybe if I didn't have, you know, if I had, like, a guy's body, like, straight hips, flat chest, that kind of thing, I wouldn't feel this way. And I kind of kept wanting that and kept thinking about it. And I was like, am I? am I trans? Like, I had to have that conversation with myself for months. Like, this went on for a very, very long time. I think I downplayed it a little bit in the Twitter thread. But yeah, this has been something I've been struggling with a lot, and it kind of came down to, if anything, I would be non-binary, but I think I'm just I feel more comfortable in, like, very masculine woman.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I definitely can understand the sort of, I don't really know what I want to be.
Right.
And that's okay.
It's okay.
It's hard, though. It's really, really hard to, like, feel that way and not know, like, how you want to be.
Right.
Yeah. That's my own personal, like, story of gender struggles.
She just dabbed. I want everyone to know, you cannot get away with that in my house. Like, you have to understand that that just happened.
Kit is banned from her own podcast.
I blame, I'm going to call out my friend Matthew for getting me into that habit of gesticulating via dab.
Do you dab to, like, detract from your emotional statements?
Yes.
Is that how it goes?
Yeah.
Like me, where I laugh really awkwardly?
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah.
I feel like dabbing after laying down some really heavy emotional conversation is, like, the equivalent of, like, if you had Heelys, you would just, like, roll away.
It's like when you say something super heavy in the chat and then you're like, LOL.
Let's talk about, so a couple other things, like, we haven't even talked about Kaname and his crush and the development of that in this yet.
Which is great.
But I want to touch on the gender and sexuality chart that we were talking about earlier.
Yes. Yeah.
Because why don't you go ahead and introduce what you were saying, Jude?
So we have Kaname sitting at the drop-in center, and he's got his little iPad, air quotes, because no copyrights in manga. And he's got a gender identity chart in front of him, and it's a gender and sexuality chart. You can't really see the questions for the last two options on the chart, but it's kind of implied that they apply more to your sexual identity than your gender identity. But the top two, you have in your heart, what's your gender? And then it's cut off in the first bit, but it says you currently identify. And you can see that Kaname himself has aligned with male, but not, like, entirely in his heart. It's slightly off from it, and then currently identify is probably a little bit more in. And then when you have the latter two, unfortunately we can't really see where those are at question wise but you've got other bits at the bottom, though. We've got definitions, and it has bisexual, romantic, asexual, and pansexual. And I really enjoyed that it had the distinction of romantic, asexual, and asexual to kind of actually have that clarification that asexuality itself is a spectrum and it does have a place in the queer community. That was really awesome to me. But it does have that, in my opinion, dated definition of bisexual, where it says has romantic relationships with both men and women, versus pansexual, loves all genders without distinction. And that ties a little bit into the kind of, like, biphobia and, you know, bisexuals transphobic thing that's been going on in the community a little bit, and online especially. And that's, you know, that's, get out of here. It's not good. So that's like a 50-50. We got a good stuff here, we got a not so good stuff here, but the asexual representation I thought was awesome.
So one thing that I wanted to bring up, I also thought that this chart was super interesting, partially because the mangaka is a ex-gendered asexual person, and so it was really cool to see that representation. But when I saw this chart, immediately my first thought was, what is it in Japanese?
I'm very curious about that too.
Well, and the reason was that when I went to the asexuality in manga panel at SakuraCon, that was one of the things that Carlene spent a lot of time going through, was the different words that are used for different orientations, as well as the connotations of those words. Because, like, in Japanese, I remember them saying the Japanese word for asexual implies someone who's eroace. And then they have a different term for someone who's a romantic asexual. And so I'm wondering, like, because we have our sort of cultural connotations for bisexual and pansexual, etc. But it's really interesting seeing how similar ideas and words have different cultural connotations. So it'd be interesting if anybody who is listening or has anything to say about that, let me know, because I would love to know. But it kind of reminds me to speak specifically to the bisexual, pansexual thing. I read a really good article on Tumblr, I want to say.
Was it that
I think it was
post?
The one you sent me.
Yeah.
About the... what did it boil down to?
Oh my god, I'm never going to find it now.
Yeah, so there was a really cool Tumblr post that Sarah showed me, where they were talking about kind of the difference between bisexual and pansexual. And I think that one of the things that they talked about was with bisexuality, gender has some distinction on attraction, whereas with pansexuality, it doesn't. And I thought, and it doesn't matter what gender it is, it's just that it has some weight in deciding if you're attracted to someone or not. And I thought that that was a really interesting way of looking at it that I had never considered before. If we find that post, I'll link it on Twitter. It was super cool. I do wonder, though, what... I don't know. I think that the localization for this is really good, so maybe that is just pretty much what it says, in which case, oh, you know, well...
Because it does say, like, asexual does not have a sexual desire for any gender, which does imply that that would be the arrow ace.
Mm-hmm.
And then romantic asexual seeks romantic relationships, but not sex.
Yeah. And I know for a fact those are two different words in Japanese.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know that there was actually... They actually did have specific verbiage for it. So that was a cool thing to learn about for me, that, like, in Japan, that they have that, and that also that it's socially something that is present and they're aware of, and it was just really cool to see.
I'll hook you up with Carlene, who is not Carlene with a C, I believe, on Twitter. They're the ones who did the asexuality and manga panel, and they're awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a whole thing about all of the different terminology, and it was really cool.
Yeah.
So I'll see if they have that anywhere.
We should just see if they can send us that,
yeah,
that
just
slide.
So that we have it for reference.
Because we keep talking about it.
Let's talk about Tsubaki and Kaname, because it keeps getting more interesting.
I know.
So I was right, and I need to, like, rub it in your face.
What?
You were like, oh, they've totally had a conversation before.
I know.
And I was like, no, they haven't. I'm pretty sure that was all metaphorical.
You were totally right.
Thank you.
I was thinking about that when I was reading it. I was like, they really haven't had a conversation. What was that from then?
I told you, it was like him thinking about it.
Oh. But what was that line where it looks like Tsubaki is saying, I just can't?
It was internal. I can't remember which page that's on, but I remember looking at that and, you know, realizing that it was kind of his internal.
All right.
Yeah.
This time I was wrong. As many times.
The first thing I want to get out of the way is the more that we learn about Tsubaki as a character, the more that I like him.
I love that he was so worried about the fish. I mean, and when I say it like that, it sounds like, aw, such a silly... No, I really thought that was amazing. Like, I thought it was so cool that he was, like, in the middle of this huge fight they were having. He was like, the fish!
Yeah.
You idiots!
One goal.
Yeah.
I really like his sort of protectiveness of life, even if it's just like goldfish.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciated that. And I like that he's cool and he's popular, but he's not like
He seems a little awkward.
He's a little bit awkward. He doesn't come off as, like, that conceited, like, popular sports boy.
Yeah.
And, like, him being cool and attractive is not his personality.
Right. Which is great, because that's kind of what Kaname is all about.
Right.
Like, I like that it's just, like, a little bit calling out Kaname for being shallow.
Yeah.
It is very good. He's got that, he's good at sports, and he's attractive, but also, like, he's friendly, but he's not too friendly, so he's got a bit of mysteriousness, so he's cool.
He's the perfect man.
He really, like, I like the sort of deconstruction of being able to take the character out of the love interest trope and make them their own complex person.
Mm-hmm.
I see that done sometimes in shoujo mangas where they separate the protagonist's crush from the person that they have a crush on.
Right.
And it's always very refreshing, I feel, when they do that. And mm-hmm. they add a little bit more of a layer of realism
mm-hmm.
to, hey, people are people.
I also thought that it was really interesting that at the end he was like, hey, that person that you saw at the drop-in center, like, who went to my school, was his name Kaname? I'm really interested to see where the plot goes, basically, mm-hmm. on a totally, like, superficial, like, following the plot level. I'm yeah. like, what's gonna happen next?
So here's a question I'll pitch to all y'all. Is Tsubaki queer? Go.
At this stage, I would say probably, but I don't know. That's just my guess from where it seems like the story is going. But this, obviously, like, the story surprises me all the time, so it could go either way.
I feel like the visual storytelling has implied to us, the reader, especially with, like, in that first bit in volume one, and then where Kaname is, like, you know, saying, that's disgusting, why would I be gay? And then him reflecting on that again in volume two, and I'm looking at it right now, him remembering that, and remembering that Tsubaki was there and saw him say that, and kind of wondering, like, oh no, like, what could he think of me? And even just Tsubaki's expression
mm-hmm.
overhearing that perhaps, maybe. There's also the page prior to that where it looks like Tsubaki is touching Kaname's ear to get his attention.
And right?
Like, why would you touch someone's ear to get their attention if you're not, like, you know?
Yeah, it is. It's a very oddly intimate moment. And then there's the panel of them, like, looking at each other.
Yeah.
Right after that. Which is, like, wouldn't you normally... I mean, I guess I don't know about, like, social norms in Japan on this subject. Like, wouldn't you normally, like, tap their shoulder or, like,
yeah.
walk in front of them? Like, put your hand in front of their face so they can see you? Or...
Mm-hmm. Hey, just...
just reach out and gently caress their ear.
Yeah.
I hope so. And I'm just saying that on a very, like, superficial fangirl level. I'm just gonna be like, I want them to be together.
I would like for Kaname's dream to come true.
And at the same time, though, I think that there's so much, like, internalized homophobia that Kaname has that needs to be addressed and moved through before he's able to, like, be in any kind of healthy relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, but narratively speaking, it could be really interesting to watch him try to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like,
while he's trying to date Tsubaki.
And actually, there is something that in recent I consumed that has a very similar sort of thing to, like, the concept you're talking about of, like, one person being totally at ease with, you know, being gay and that, you know, being together with the person that they care about versus the other person that's like, I love this person, but also, you know, I'm not sure about coming out. Aside from the very clear example of Daichi and Saki already in the manga itself. In Vampire by... oh god, Don't Nod Entertainment, there is a couple of the characters, Newton and Oswald, and they are a gay couple that met in the war, and they fell in love, and Oswald's just like, yeah, I love him, I'm not gonna, you know, hide that, I love him. And Newton is a little bit more like, you know, what are people going to think? Like, you know, I love him too, but like, we can't just be out here like telling everybody sort of thing. And it does create an interesting dynamic, and I care about them very much. But yeah, so seeing that with Kaname and Tsubaki would definitely be interesting. But also, like, I feel like maybe if Tsubaki is queer, that he's probably processed his identity, and he's not at odds with it, but he's probably just not open.
Right.
Because there's that bit when his father comes home from being at the drop-in center and kind of is just a little low-key queerphobic. I'm trying to find the page so that I can see the dialogue.
I am a big fan of the way that Daichi just totally shuts down his queerphobic father, by the way.
She just puts a cat in his face.
Yeah.
It's great.
Gay people are not horny zombies who only think about love and sex 24/7. I love that line.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. And I love the bit because it's like, you know, cats are supposed to ward away evil. And so just her having the cat in his face was excellent.
And then he's like, oh, I didn't mean it like that. And she's like, I know. Bye-bye. Like, I love Daichi.
And I love the panel at the bottom of that page with all of the, like black aura surrounding her where she's just like, ugh. It's very good. I think Daichi's my favorite character, honestly. I love her.
She is great.
She is so good.
I mean, it's hard to choose a favorite because they're all so good and interesting.
I want, like, I think Mizora is second. I just want them to be okay.
Right. Yeah.
And I hope that they are able to come back because I want to see more of them. I thought they were super cool.
Mm-hmm.
And Misora's story is interesting because it's like definitely for queer youth, it's something that you can connect with. But also, I got to thinking about how you oftentimes have older folks that come out as being trans late in life, you know, especially people that were in the military, you know, like they're in their 50s or 60s, 70s even. And I believe there's even people in their 80s that have come out and they were like, you know, I was in the military and I didn't feel like I could like be honest with myself, or, you know, I hadn't thought about it till now, but I finally kind of like realized, and, you know, this is who I am. And it's like better that I actually got to realize it, even if it was so late, you know, I can at least be happy now, sort of thing.
Right.
Yes.
So it was also a thing that I thought about, where figuring out who you are is not something exclusive just to youth, but it is also something that any age can experience. So like maybe Misora won't figure it out now. Maybe Misora will figure it out in like 30 years from now.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and I feel like there's like something that this made me think of is I feel like there's a lot of pressure, especially right now, like in just in kind of how our like wider queer discourse has been. Like, I feel like there's a lot of pressure on people to be like, I'm this. Like, mm-hmm. pick a label and stick with it. And, you know, if you change your mind later, then you're fake. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I
feel like the cancel culture is real.
I feel like it's so, so harmful. Like, we really need to let people I keep repeating myself, but we need to let people, like, rest in that uncertainty. And even if Misora never decides, that's okay. Like, you don't have to pick a label.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the biggest parts of like learning who you are is having that freedom to question your identity and like explore it. And, you know, if you explore it and it doesn't feel right, then you checked that box and you figure it out from there, like process of elimination. Like, this didn't work for me, so what does?
The way that I kind of describe my sexuality to people is like, this is just a shorthand so that if I say I'm a lesbian, you know, you can kind of generally understand what I'm about, but that doesn't encapsulate my entire identity. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, it's not like a set list of traits that you know, I have checked every box and ascribe to everyone. Like, this is just an abbreviation.
Well, and I struggle with that, too, between going ping-ponging back and forth between referring to myself as a lesbian and referring to myself as bisexual. And I feel sometimes more comfortable in the former because I feel like it's easier than explaining, and I'm going to steal this joke from Twitter, that my bisexuality is being attracted to all women and, like, four types of men. Just because, like, you know, there is no, and I think that they address this fairly well in this volume, is even if you have the same label as someone, there's no one that's going to be 100% the same orientation as you. Mm-hmm. They're a good shorthand, and they're good for, you know, maybe finding other people that are like you, but there's never going to be a label that is going to 100% describe everyone, and that's okay.
Right. Yeah.
Similar concept. There are times where I joke a lot about, you know, if someone that was a really insistent preacher or, like, Christian salesperson sort of thing approached me and whatnot, I'd just be like, yeah, I'm a Satanist, sorry. Because it's, like, it's a very easy blanket thing to say.
Right.
But if you actually look into Satanism, there are so many different varieties and archetypes of Satanism out there. So, again, like, you could say one blanket label, but there's, like, tons of different variations underneath it that, you know, it's the same thing with gender and sexual identity.
Right. Yeah. And so it's just, like, it's easy to just be like, hey, I'm gay, but... You know, just because you meet another person who's like, oh, hey, I'm also gay. Like, that person has had a completely different life experience from you and has arrived at their, you know, this place where they're saying as a shorthand, hey, I'm gay, in a completely different way. And I don't know. I guess I'm just like, we all need to remember that we are all multifaceted human beings with a great depth of experiences within us. And just because, like, somebody changes labels doesn't mean it was a phase or they were fake or something like that. Like, people can change. They can think about things more. They can think about things in a different way. They can, you know, just because you were like, oh, I guess, I don't know, like, somebody who said they were trans, like, at one point, and then they're like, actually, I'm trans, but I'm non-binary. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That doesn't mean that, like, the time that you identified as, like, a binary trans person was wrong or fake. It just means that you have thought about it more and come to a different conclusion, and that's fine.
And to dip into, like, my own personal experience a little bit, when I had moved out, so it's like a whole thing. When I had first come out to my mom again, she was a little bit, like, unsure. Like, it was really funny because, you know, when she was 8, she's like, you can do whatever you want when you're 18. But then when I came out, she's like, but you're really good at being a girl. Like, why would you want to change that? So I was like, okay, so there's this concept called bigender. And then, you know, like, if it makes you more comfortable and easier for you to digest, you know, I'm bigender. I'll go by that. You know, I'll have boy days and I'll have girl days. It was one of those things where, like, I shouldn't have had to make that compromise, sure, but I was willing to make that compromise at the very least because, like, I cared about my mom and I didn't want to lose a relationship with her. And then when I moved out here to Washington, away from the Midwest and whatnot, and trying to, you know, figure out, like, okay, yeah, there are better resources for transitioning and stuff like that, and dealing with, like, the family that I was living with, Amanda's family at the time, just, like, their own personal confusion of being like, you know, well, which is it today? It's like you're wearing, like, a skirt, so, like, it's a girl day, right? And it's like, no, it's actually a boy day. I'm just wearing a skirt because I like it. And then eventually just being like, just you know what, all the way, all male, he, him, pronouns, don't, you know. And then trying to figure out, like, healthcare, trying to figure out, like, can I get hormones, the process of qualifying for surgeries and everything like that. And, like, the regulations were so strict back then that it was the stepping stone of, like, you know, am I going to be trans enough to convince the medical professionals that I can receive hormones? And it was one of those things where I'd figured out, like, internally, I was just like, I feel like, you know, more of this androgynous, non-binary, like, you know, leaning more towards male, but kind of middle-ish sort of identity of myself, but you couldn't just be that and then still get hormones. So it was like, okay, I have to ascribe to a very, like, hyper-masculine, like, all-male, very binary identity in order to actually be, like, qualifiable. So I did that, and it... It really sucked, one, because, like, I wanted to be able to dress in a way that I was comfortable with and fit more who I was, and I couldn't, because, you know, trying to make sure that I was crossing through all these hoops. But then also, like, because of my body type and how my voice was, and generally, like, what people's first impressions would be on the outset, everyone just thought that I was a butch lesbian. and that was extremely rough for all of my dysphoria. And then, you know, now I am at this point where I've started, you know, hormone therapy, and you know, been doing it for long enough that I can kind of, like, ease back into, like, I still get misgendered on occasion, and actually it's really funny, I get misgendered more when I have a beard than when I don't. which is wild in its own way.
How does that work?
And, like, because the thing is, like, when I have a beard, I don't look like how bearded women present themselves, because bearded women present themselves in such a different way that's, it's me as a beard, I don't look like a bearded lady at all. But I still get misgendered when I have a beard more than when I shave, and I don't know where that comes from, but it does. It happens.
That's super weird.
And it's absolutely wild, but, like, now that it's more acceptable to be non-binary, I'm actually, you know, more open about that. Hey, I am more masculine identifying than I am feminine identifying, but I am trans masculine. I'm non-binary also. It's all of it. It exists together. And that's totally fine. People are allowed to have these journeys. And it'll be interesting to see how Miss Sora's development is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so excited for volume 3 and 4 of this manga.
And doesn't volume 3 come out later this year?
Probably. I should have looked that up before we started, but did I? No. So I guess that brings us to our question, which is, y'all, would we recommend this book to others?
I mean, yeah, like, if you haven't already read the first one, please go read it, because it's so interesting, and it's so good, and it is really, like, it really makes you think about things in a way that you might not have before. Like, I feel like I learn something every time I read it.
And I do, too. Like, I definitely had to, like, call myself out and be like, oh, I'm learning new things, and it's awesome.
It's like, it makes you feel seen, but it also makes you feel like, oh, there's so much more I need to know about the people around me.
Which is awesome. Yeah. I love it. What do you think, Jude?
I would definitely recommend it. I enjoyed reading it, one, to see how, like, from a story writing perspective, how things have progressed culturally for Japan, because that, I know, affects a lot of, like, how things have been in media, is just the way that, like, the cultural setting is for queer people. And so to see that it's taken strides, and you can see that in the media, but then also, like, it does get a little bit stressful to read, and, like, I definitely cried quite a few times reading it, because it was extremely, like, personal and visceral, but in a way that, like, it definitely, like, yeah, you feel seen. And also, I do have the date for
volume. Yeah, we looked it up, you looked it up, and Aaron put it in the chat.
September 24th, according to Amazon.
And also, Tsubaki is on the cover of the third one, so...
Yes. And he's looking so handsome. He's got a cardigan and the top two buttons of his shirt undone.
Yes.
I love it.
And he's making that serious face.
I love the angles on his face. Like, we didn't talk about the art in this one as much as we did in the first one, because the art continues to just be perfect and gorgeous. But I really do like how everyone has a different face shape and is, like, super attractive and interesting in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a really nice blend of stylized and realistic.
Mm-hmm. Like, I think that it's, especially with Tsubaki, is, like, one of the first quote-unquote anime or manga characters where I know exactly what this person would look like in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if they came up to me, I'd be like, you're Tsubaki from Our Dreams at Dusk.
Yeah.
So with that, let's go ahead and transition into listener questions. If you are a listener and you have a question, go ahead and put it in the chat. And in the meantime, I will check all of our other avenues for listener questions. We do have a question. So, from rwingpilot114, something I see a lot of people talk about online is the debate if it's okay to ask for pronouns for people, and I guess knowing when the appropriate time would be to ask someone for their pronouns.
This is something I'm super, super bad about, because I try to just, like, figure it out from context clues because I'm such an awkward human.
Yeah.
But I feel like we really do need to normalize just asking people for their pronouns, even if you think you know them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually part a little bit about of like the stuff that I've been working on with my workplace and whatnot. So a lot of people in the workplace started wearing pronoun pins, just like, you know, little custom pins and everything like that. And then there was this whole conversation about, like, you know, people would get misgendered even when wearing the pronoun pins, even myself. And then it was Pride Month, and there was a lot of the very intense trans-targeted violence that was going on in Seattle. You know, I was talking to HR. I was like, you know, I used to wear a pronoun pin. You'll notice that I don't wear it anymore. And part of that is being afraid that, you know, when trans people wear pronoun pins, it creates a visual target. And if it's normalized in culture for everyone, whether you're cis or trans, to state your pronouns or wear a pronoun pin, then it takes away that level of visual or social targeting, because trans-centered violence can be so random, and it can come from anywhere, and it can come from people that you trust. And so it can be very difficult and worrisome for someone to even just feel safe being like, hey, my pronouns are this, if they know that that's going to, you know, out them in some sort of way. And I will admit myself, I'm also bad at asking for pronouns, but that also comes from my own personal anxiety of, like, if I correct people. I've had so many instances of people, like, you know, deflecting their embarrassment at me and making me feel awkward. So I don't ask because it already makes me feel insecure. But I really feel like if socially it was more normalized, it would just be a case of, like, you know, hi, I'm such and such, you go in for a handshake, my pronouns are this, you know, it's stating your own pronouns. And if somebody doesn't state their pronouns themselves, you could just be like, what are your pronouns, in that first moment interaction. Because otherwise I feel like it can be really socially awkward to try and ask at a later time. So, like, at that point of first contact, I feel is, like, the best opening that you have to ask and to clarify your own. And I feel like accompanying it by, like, stating my pronouns are this, you know, what are yours, helps tie it in so you're not just singling out the other person. And it's definitely something I personally also need to work on. It's just also from a place of, like, very intense social anxiety.
Yeah, It's so, well, and when I say I try to figure it out from context clues, I mean, I try to listen to what pronouns other people use for them, and then I just do that, and it's, which is not great. I should just buck up and ask.
I'm currently working on unlearning gendering strangers. So, like, when I see someone at the grocery store that I think is, like, attractive or, like, wearing something cool, saying, oh, look at their shirt, rather than looking at his or her shirt.
Oh, look at that cool-looking person.
Yeah.
I tried to work on that, too.
And that's been my personal challenge. And I still catch myself sometimes. But I think working on trying to not gender someone until I know what their gender is a big thing that I think would be cool if it was more normalized outside of the queer community.
Yeah.
And also, I just want to point out, if we're talking about pronoun pins, if you go on Etsy, there are like 5 bazillion really cool pronoun pins.
There's so many cool ones.
If you just want to have, like, you know, if you feel like it's weird if you don't have, like, a cute accessory or something, you can make it cute. It's okay.
Cacophony, who has been on Tomo Chaco before doing music, they have some cute they-them pronoun pins that they wear on their jackets.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to state, I don't unfortunately have like the specific shop names or the listings, but I can go out and like search for them and like send them off so they can be linked somewhere on like Twitter and whatnot. But I have seen my absolute favorite pronoun pins are the ones for people who are gender fluid, where they're like a spinner or they have a slider. And so they have like the
they're so cool.
And you can move it around. So like whatever your pronouns are for that day, like those are the coolest pronoun pins.
Yeah.
That's dope. I love that.
So to, I guess, all of our fellow queer people, even if you're cis, consider buying a pronoun pin.
Well, I think especially if you're cis. Get some pronoun pins.
Yeah, get some pronoun pins, because we really do need to work on this, you know, normalizing it so that it's not just, like, we're not just making trans people carry all of that themselves. Like, that's rough.
Well, and I mean, that even goes back to the age-old Twitter argument that we're past of, is it okay for cis people to put their pronouns in their bio? Yes.
Yeah. And to follow up a little bit of resolution for anyone that was concerned listening about like my workplace debacle about pronouns and pins and whatnot, there was a motion made for our official name tags to have a section for people to put their pronouns on their name tag along with
That's
their
amazing.
Name and their job position. Yeah. Having the pronouns on the name tags is optional, so people that don't want to do it don't have to. But it is a thing that has been standardized across the company, which is super cool.
I need to patronize your place of work more often because mm-hmm. I want to support that kind of business practice. So anyway, I think that's it for our listener questions. Let's go ahead and wrap some stuff up. Jude, plug your stuff.
I am at Kirk Dupe on Twitter. I have been talking a little bit recently about the horror tabletop RPG that I'm developing for a game jam that's going on right now. So if you're into horror, and it is a mature game, so if you're over 18 and you're into tabletops, definitely look forward to checking that out. The title for it is The Giver's Contract. And then also on Instagram at Luciferi Cosplay, that is Lucifer, the letter I, cosplay, all jammed together. You can see more of my cosplay stuff. I haven't been updating a lot recently because I haven't been working on a lot of cosplay. But cosplay season is going to be continuing soon, so there will be more cosplay stuff upcoming.
Excellent. Oh, tell everybody about your pins, because I'm sure that they will want to buy them.
Oh, yes. Also, I do also have some enamel pin designs of my own, and I have the Magical Trans Asterisk Formation pin on Etsy. It was inspired by my love of magical girl transformation media that has recently also branched out into just magical person transformation media. And I thought that it was a fun way to have that metaphor of like becoming like your best self and whatnot. The colors are the Trans Pride flag, and it has that little human silhouette with a heart and then ribbons coming out of it. So it is more visually inspired by Sailor Moon for sure. But just in general, it's a visual metaphoric tie-in to like my love of that. So the Magical Transformation pin on Etsy, you can find it. It is $10 a piece, and the shipping is like $2-something. You can have your own magical transformation pin as well.
Well, excellent. And of course, if you want to follow the podcast on Twitter or Tumblr, that is at Tomo Chaco Pod. If you have a longer thought, if you think that we said something that was incorrect, or you want to reach out to us because we can do better, please email us at tomochacopodcast@gmail.com. We always are looking to learn from our past mistakes, and so anything that anyone can do to help us do so, please use that email. Or if you're interested in coming on the show, or you just want to tell us something about one of the books that we read, that is tomochacopodcast@gmail.com. If you are enjoying the show and you want to help it out, please, I don't say this enough, go ahead and give us a review on iTunes. That would help us quite a bit. Thank you to Noke for the use of the song Wander as the intro and outro of our program. It's a great song, and you can find them if you search Noke on YouTube. I believe their YouTube is Video Game Remixes. And other than that, I have been Kit. You can find me on Twitter at Pink Roomba and on my dead Tumblr as Bright Pink Roomba.
And I've been Sarah. You can find me on Twitter at Chest. I forgot my own Twitter handle again. Chest of Stars. And on Tumblr at Stardusty Heart. And on Pillowfort at Chest Full of Stars.
Pillowfort sent me an email asking me to come back. It was really cute.
Aww, you should come back.
Thank you, Jude, so much for coming on the show. We loved having you.
It was a pleasure being here.
Yeah, yes. Thank you so much.
We'll definitely have to find an excuse to have you come back because this was great.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much to everyone who tuned into the live show and who are listening on the whatever podcast app that you choose.
And thank you so much for all of your chats and comments in the Twitch chat. It was really active, and that makes me happy.
Yeah, it was super cool. We'll be back in 2 weeks with what are we watching, Sarah?
Oh, Miss Vampire Who Lives in My Neighborhood.
So something very, very
completely
silly.
Different and silly. I think it's just 12 episodes.
Yeah.
Came out like last year, 2 years ago or something like that.
So that's what we'll be doing next. And until then, thank you all for listening. Thank you again, Jude, for coming on. And remember, Tomo Chaco, it's good enough.